Thank you for downloading this programme from BBC Radio 4. For more information, visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.
It's not the greatest rendition of the national anthem since its first official performance for George II in 1745. But for each of the singers, it's a landmark, a song to mark a new identity and a new life. For these are the voices of New Britons.
I need you to repeat after me, okay? I will give my loyalty.
To the United Kingdom.
And respect its rights and freedoms.
They've come from Ghana, Bulgaria, Pakistan, Albania, India, Afghanistan and the Philippines. 20 new citizens in a council register office in East Ham on a grey day in February.
And fulfil my duties and obligations. As a British citizen.
There's not too much pomp. A portrait of the Queen and some Union flags provide a backdrop for souvenir photographs. But the participants mean what they say and what they sing. There's a sense in the room that this is a long-held dream made real.
It is indeed my honour to say congratulations to you all and a round of applause in support of one another.
We've been waiting for a long time, so for us it was like, oh, finally! Now we know that we are British now.
It's very easy to be free, in any means of the word free. Freedom to work and be honest.
People are friendly here.
They are very wide open. It's open to every individual, no matter your race.
To me it means a fair and equitable society. I think it's a great country to be a part of.
I think that too, because I'm also one of the beneficiaries of this society. My father came here in the 1950s from Malta, played football for Newcastle, and married a British woman with whom he raised three sons. We all live here, and so do our children. As far as I'm concerned, to be a British citizen is to get lucky in the global lottery. But why? What is it to be British? Why on earth would anyone want to be British? And is it possible to debate the meaning of Britishness without sounding like a platitude factory? There are plenty of people that think we are fast losing our sense of national identity. All sorts of forces are blamed for this supposed erosion of old-fashioned patriotism. Economic globalisation, immigration, European integration, the weakening of the Union, the end of deference, the growth of cynicism, the curdling spread of apathy. Others take a less doom-laden approach. Yes, they say, there are indeed a range of pressures making an impact upon British identity in the early 21st century. So it's high time we acknowledge them and set about redefining Britishness for the world today rather than the world of the 1950s. That's the focus of this first programme. Is the debate about Britishness needed? Is it really worth having? Let's start by taking the temperature on the British High Street.
I see Britishness as queuing and drinking tea.
Cricket, fair play.
I'd like to say democracy, but I'm not so sure about that particularly.
Polite, mannerly. It's all like keep yourself to yourself and stiff upper lip.
Work, go to the pub, pay the mortgage.
There's no such thing as Britishness. It's all mixed up, isn't it?
Fish and chips, roast beef on a Sunday.
I hate these debates like Gordon Brown tried to get going. It's playing up to nationalism, patriotism the wrong way.
Well, at least someone knows the Prime Minister has been trying to get a debate up and running on Britishness. What he almost certainly doesn't know is for how long this has been an obsession for Gordon Brown. The first time he mentioned it to me was back in 1998. More recently, he and I have been collaborating on a book about Britishness. I asked the Prime Minister why, with so much on his plate, he's still eager to get stuck into a spot of British topside.
I think the first time I went to America and looked at what people thought of themselves as Americans, and went into bookshops in America and found there were so many books about the idea of America, the values of America, the identity of America, what America is and who Americans are. And then looked at the debate in Britain and found that we so were wedded to the idea of evolution and to almost empiricism, that we had not considered that actually our national identity, more so than America, and earlier than America, was founded on our values. That we, in Britain, invented the modern idea of tolerance, that we were responsible for developing out of that into an idea of liberty, and actually the American Wars of Independence were fought with people arguing that they were both, on both sides, supporting the idea of liberty. And I just thought the way we look at British history and the way we look at our sense of ourselves has been distorted by, first of all, an overemphasis on institutions and sometimes race and ethnicity. And I thought, look at Britain. The ideas that have shaped our history are ones of tolerance, liberty, fairness, and we should both be proud of it, and we should both see that as the basis on which we can move ahead as a country. That is giving ourselves a stronger sense of national purpose than we have.
How do you prevent the debate descending into a statement of fairly banal, woolly things like just decency and tolerance that any country on earth could claim? How do you make it specifically British?
Well, I think that is where history comes in. I mean, too much of our history is written as the history of individual people or the history of institutions. But if you look at what we mean by liberty, I mean, go back to the historians Macaulay and everybody writing in the 19th century, they had a very particular view of what we meant by British liberty. And then look at how in the 20th century the idea of fairness has become more powerful as an idea, whether it was Churchill talking about fair play or whether it was the National Health Service that was seen as a peculiarly British way of being fair to people and taking care of everybody in your community. I think the relationship between tolerance, liberty, fairness and ideas of justice are not the same in every country. I mean, if you take tolerance, it's pretty clear that tolerance was important for Britain, first of all, because you had Scotland, England, Wales, Northern Ireland. People had to find a way of living together, and that happened throughout a number of centuries. And secondly, because of the freedom of thought that developed in Britain, and particularly how it applied to religion, then tolerance had a particular meaning here.
Using your historical perspective, but also as a politician, as a head of government, what persuades you about the context of 2009, that we need to be explicit about this? Because the British tradition, as you implied, has been to look at this as an evolutionary, unspoken matter almost.
Well, the problem is, if it is not explicit in the modern world, then we give ourselves a false sense of who we are. We define ourselves by race or ethnicity, which would be a disaster for a country that has many people with different backgrounds as part of it. Or we just describe ourselves in terms of unchanging institutions, which would mean that we were frozen in the past. But I think the most important thing in a year like 2009, we're entering this global age. We tend to think of the financial crisis that we're going through as an event. It's in fact the process of global change. It's global financial system, global flows of people, global flows of capital, global sourcing of goods. And any nation faced with the bewildering amount of change, opportunity, yes, but also insecurity, needs a sense of national purpose. And therefore, to root your sense of national purpose in the values that people can generally agree to is really the important way that we can face all the difficult challenges of globalization. And I'm not just talking about the economy, I'm talking about climate change, I'm talking about security, how we deal with Europe as well as how we deal with the rest of the world. And to be able to do that, I think you need a strong national sense of purpose. Ironically, globalization may change a whole set of institutions because they've got to change to adapt to it. But if you have lasting values on which you base the national sense of purpose you have, then I think that makes all the difference to our ability to succeed or fail.
One thing Gordon Brown is dead right about is this. We can't depend on the old institutions to enshrine quietly our sense of national identity any longer. I'm standing in front of the irreproachable old lady of Threadneedle Street, the Bank of England, which Brown himself made independent in 1997, and which for more than three centuries was the symbol of Britain's prized financial probity. And yet, the shockwaves that are still rumbling through the square mile, the calamities that have overturned the city and led to banks being nationalised, All that has shown how fragile institutions like this one can be, no matter how long established, no matter how apparently robust and immune to the operations of chance. The city, the armed forces, the monarchy, the Church of England, Parliament, each of these institutions and others like them have suffered and shrunk in recent decades. And the old assumption that these great symbolic bodies in national life would almost automatically transmit national identity from one generation to the next is no longer safe. The building blocks of the past are no longer fit for purpose. But not everyone agrees that this spells doom for Britishness.
There's a crisis in the financial sector. That's real. You can measure it. What is this crisis in national identity? I don't see any evidence for it.
Jonathan Clark is a conservative historian whose tracts on British and American history since 1688 are both immensely scholarly and immensely controversial. Crisis, says Clark. What crisis?
I think all these moments of definition are extremely dangerous in world affairs. If you look at states that have been challenged to define their national identities anew around some creed or doctrine, this is almost always a totalitarian movement. I think this is, if I may say so, it's very un-English, but also I think it's un-Scottish, un-Irish, and un-Welsh as well.
So you actually would see a quite sinister, almost authoritarian streak in the current project to define Britishness then?
Yes, it certainly is dictatorial to say that there is just one set of core beliefs. Just as in the past, it was dictatorial to say that some nation had one core race at its heart. There are certain rough similarities in British history, but they are broad and flexible, but these tend not to place extraordinary demands on people.
Clark isn't the only scholar who doesn't buy Brown's calls for a statement of British values. John Gray is a philosopher who's been through a complex evolution over the years, rather like a great British institution, and he thinks that the whole point about Britishness is that it isn't explicit.
The advantage of old-fashioned Britishness and of the British makeshift has been that it's not creedal. One can be British without ever specifying one's beliefs or deciding them. It's really just a matter of being loyal to the state and rubbing along together.
But if Gordon Brown were here, he would say that actually we've reached a moment of crisis and a time when, due to changes going on the global stage and forces of modernity, we do need to define Britishness. Do you dispute that?
I do dispute that. What we inherit has the, I think, great advantage that it doesn't require statements of faith from British citizens. It doesn't require them to surrender their pasts or their beliefs. All it requires, and this is a very important requirement, is the commitment to coexist in peace with other British people on a basis of tolerance. And I think moving away from that to some rather chintzy statement of principles about equality or fairness risks either having something vague and indeterminate, which could then be interpreted by judges along the lines of the orthodoxies of the day, or if it was more precise, it would be divisive.
Now, Gray is right when he says that a statement of British values could end up being cheesier than a shop full of greetings cards. But I think the British makeshift to which he refers is now so makeshift that it barely exists. Our idea of national identity is not so much implicit as barely there at all. If you don't believe me, here are some more thoughts from the High Street on what makes us British.
I define Britishness as having the ability to explore, cross new boundaries.
Shopping.
Union Jack flag.
Eccentric.
An empire we haven't got no more.
Brutality, colonialism.
We've got standards, haven't we, and different to a lot of people in different countries.
I'd probably say the monarchy, even though I don't agree with the concept.
The hunt.
Free healthcare.
Fat women with their midriff showing.
General slovenliness.
No respect for the elder.
No respect for anybody.
Posh. Yeah, scones.
Scones? Two world wars and one world cup and scones? Doesn't exactly quicken the pulse, does it? Maybe we Brits have spent so long hiding our light under a bushel, we've forgotten we had one. And maybe it's time we broke the habit of a millennium and started behaving a bit more like the people who gave the world the very word, chauvinism. Mais oui, c'est vrai, les Français. I've come, if not to France, then to a French outpost. There's a zinc bar in the corner, foie gras on the menu, and the walls are covered with tricolore and adverts for colourful French travel destinations. This is Mon Plaisir, London's oldest French restaurant, and I'm here for a lesson in patriotism from one of Britain's best-known Frenchmen, P.Y. Gerbault.
the quite shocking thing when I moved into your country 9 years ago now is that you don't even have a celebration for your national day.
What would the national day be, though?
Well, I don't know. You choose. You got enough time to celebrate how badly you beat the French through the history.
In 2000, Gerbeau moved to London to try to salvage the Millennium Dome, a fiasco in the history of British national identity, if ever there was one. And though he settled here, he still feels passionately French.
You know, proud to be French is something I see absolutely everywhere. I struggle to find that pride in the British society.
Do you think it's is it natural British reticence and the fact that we think that it's something a bit showy about being patriotic?
No, I'll totally agree with that. I think the natural reserve of the Brits plays also on that.
Could Britain learn to love, though, a fairly explicit patriotism? Could it ever do that?
Well, I think it does, but again, it's a kind of je ne sais quoi laid back thing because, you know, France go mad. I mean, I'm not a football fan, but who do I support in this country? Arsenal, because they're French, you know. So it's created this enthusiasm around events. Your problem is, in most of the sports, there's no national team. There's no British team.
Are there any practices that we can import from France?
Wherever you go, public school or private school, you're going to do éducation civique, which teaches you what is to be a citizen and what is important about being a French citizen. And I think that would be a tremendous, you know, especially with such a multicultural aspects of Britain today. I think don't make it complicated. You know, don't make it big values. It's about the day-to-day. If you sit on the bus and there's a lady or an older person who stands, you just get up. Or, you know, you need to appreciate good food. And, you know, going out doesn't mean getting plastered every time.
I agree with P.Y. Gerbeau about the curriculum. If there is such a thing as Britishness, its last best hope is what goes on in the classroom. But you certainly couldn't translate éducation civique from the French lycée to the inner-city British secondary school. There is little understanding or recognition in the French system that identities are multiple, and that just isn't realistic in contemporary Britain. The tensions we have to deal with today are not only between people, but within them. And if we consciously seek to intervene in the formation of people's identity, let's first be clear what we're doing.
All identities, in the end, are political projects.
Steve Reicher is a social psychologist at the University of St Andrews and has been studying national identity for nearly 20 years.
Identities are attempts to define for a community what it should be doing, what it should be prioritising, what sort of policies it should follow, what sort of people it should follow as well. So it's not that somehow Gordon Brown is politicising identity whereas others have this pure notion of identity. It's just that we should be aware that when anybody starts a conversation about identity, they are involved in the political question of what should our priorities be for the future.
It's a good point. Identity, because it defines how we relate to each other and how we interact, is political by its very nature, and it follows that whoever tries to intervene in its formation is doing something political, which, according to Michael Gove, Tory frontbencher and close ally of David Cameron, is the problem with Gordon Brown's crusade.
I think it's undoubtedly the case that when Gordon Brown looks at specific examples of what Britishness mean, he's attempting to annex centre-left values and centre-left causes to the broader cause of Britishness. And he's trying to do two things. He's trying specifically to steal from the right the mantle of patriotism, which has traditionally sat on centre-right shoulders. And he's also trying to use the energy that patriotism can infuse a political project with to animate support for specific causes, like, for example, his belief in the current system of taxpayer funding for the National Health Service. The way in which he invokes the NHS, say, as a repository of British values, while I actually tend to agree with them, is also a deliberate, conscious and calculated attempt to say, me, New Labour, we're patriotic, and the things for which we stand are things for which every Briton should stand.
What's the Conservative Party's response? Is it to say, actually, the whole project is a bit suspect? Or is it to say, the project is legitimate, but there are many ways of addressing it? And if so, what would be the Conservative Party's answer to the question?
I think the Conservative Party absolutely agrees that because of all the changes through which Britain has been living over the last 10, 15, 25 years, that a conversation about Britishness, how it's evolved, how it's changing, why it should be defended, is relevant and important. But one of the dangers of the conversation that Gordon Brown has started is that rather than trying to find the truth about Britishness and acknowledge that perhaps some of the questions he has to ask will challenge some of his own assumptions, Gordon Brown tries to fashion and twist the whole debate so that it ends up validating or underwriting the assumptions that he's already made.
Yes, but maybe that's simply true of anyone who embarks on a task of definition like this one. The psychologist Steve Reicher and his team at St Andrews have been looking at the techniques which all politicians deploy when they seek to define identity.
Take a simple example. What does it mean to be Scottish? Well, what we tended to find from Labour politicians was they would say, well, to be Scottish is to be communal, to believe in a welfare state. They would quote Burns, and they would say, therefore, our welfarist policies, our support for public services, reflects the true Scottishness. And then we go to Conservatives, and Conservatives would say, well, look, a true Scottish identity is entrepreneurial. Look at the great entrepreneurs of the 19th century. Look at Andrew Carnegie. Look at those who built the railways in the US. And therefore, Conservative policies reflect the entrepreneurial spirit. And then the SNP, the Scottish National Party, and they would talk about how Scottishness is fundamentally about independence. It's about valuing your autonomy. So again, the Scottish National Party's policy of independence reflects Scottishness. Now, in each case, they are talking to the same audience, and therefore they're using the same identity of Scottishness to encompass that whole audience, but they're defining the meaning of that identity in very different ways. So for each one, their policies reflect the national identity.
Ah, yes, Scottishness. It's the tartan elephant in the room, isn't it? There are those who think that Gordon Brown's obsession with Britain is just a Union Jack draped desperately over the fact that he is, well, Scottish. That's an injustice to the intellectual depth of his commitment to the subject. What is true is that Scotland's recent history is the driving force behind this debate. Devolution was meant to save the Union, but it might prove to be just a step closer to disintegration. And certainly, defenders of the UK as a united nation seem pretty thin on the ground in Glasgow.
The union between the countries, I don't think it exists. It never has existed.
I think being linked, yes, we need to be. I don't think like going our separate ways would be a good thing.
I've fought for 52 years for independence.
I mean, there's obviously benefits having the country all together, you know, for the economy and things like that. But if I had to vote, I'd probably vote for independence.
And he's not alone.
I think that the union has lasted. I don't think it's going to last very much longer.
Christopher Harvey, historian and member of the Scottish Parliament. In 1979, he produced a catchily titled pamphlet with Gordon Brown, The Scottish Assembly and Why You Must Vote for It. Back then, he was a Labour man and wanted Scotland to be one of a number of self-governing constitutional units within an overarching British structure. But these days, he's a member of the Scottish Nationalist Party.
I think it would be much the best solution to live, as my First Minister has said, of course, with his own agenda, to live as good neighbours rather than as surly tenants. And I think as good neighbours, we can actually have a civilised Scandinavian relationship. It's going to be on that scale. We've passed our zenith.
For Harvey, Britishness is just a euphemism for what England wants. The UK is heading for divorce, and the reason is the psychological damage done to its other constituent nations by a sense of humiliation and resentment that London has cheated and swindled the rest of the Union.
Recent work in the archives of the British government in the 1970s showed that when North Sea oil was discovered, the attitude of Whitehall was just to stop the Scots getting their hands on any of it, and in fact using the money to increase transportation links for Southeast England. So 30 years on, we know that Britishness in fact meant London first. And I think that this notion that behind the Patriot, and Bernard Shaw must have said this time and again, was a big fat man with money bags, it's still one that means that I think with well-merited suspicion, the provinces regard London as a political unit which will use patriotism.
And the flip side is something which barely existed when I was growing up. a resentful Englishness and a growing chippiness south of the border about the money that flows to Scotland, the separate assemblies set up by the Scots, Welsh and Northern Irish, and their disproportionate representation in the Westminster Parliament. A distinctly English voice is emerging.
The Welsh Assembly, they've set themselves up, and the Scottish Assembly are setting themselves up, and they want to be segregated from England. And so I think that it makes probably Englishmen feel as if they want to stand by themselves as well and say, well, up yours then.
The Welsh, they're Welsh, the Scottish are Scottish, the Irish are Irish, and the English are English. And I don't really class myself as British, I'm English.
I think we're all fed up with hearing the Scottish moaning considerably, and the Welsh. So why wouldn't you, as an Englishman, feel slightly peeved?
Not very fraternal, is it? There you hear the authentic voice of resentful Albion. It's a voice that's getting louder, and to some eyes, the eventual breakup of the Union is now a done deal.
All states break up sooner or later. The breakup of the United Kingdom within the context of the European Union would not be a huge catastrophe. The Republic of Ireland has prospered mightily within the European context.
The historian Norman Davis, author of The Isles, A History.
States rise and fall, change and are transformed, and sooner or later they all break up. You know, the great example before everybody's eyes is the Soviet Union. Nobody could believe that a political unit of that size and power could break up, and yet it just exploded. We shouldn't think that we are somehow free from the processes of change which happen all around us.
That's true, but unlike the USSR, Britain is an idea that hasn't run out of steam. Yes, many of our traditional institutions are in crisis, but part of the British genius is a capacity to create new institutions which quickly command national allegiance. The 20th century yielded the BBC, the NHS and the National Lottery. Nor are the older British institutions necessarily doomed. Who'd have thought in 1997, the year of Diana's death, that the monarchy would go on to adapt and revive itself to the extent that it has? There's always a risk of confusing crisis with extinction. And that applies to the idea of Britain as a whole. I think Gordon Brown is right that the idea is in crisis, but Brown is wrong to place so much faith in something as vague as values and to believe that listing them will make much difference. The road to irrelevance is paved with good intentions. But the battle to reclaim and revitalise Britishness doesn't have to be irrelevant. Think of the moving enthusiasm of those new citizens we heard at the start of the programme. Can we bottle that feeling and get it back into the bloodstream of a nation that in so many respects has lost its way and its self-confidence? That's what I'll be asking in the second and final part of this series.
If you've enjoyed this programme, you might like to try other Radio 4 podcasts, from Friday Night Comedy and Daily Drama from the Archers to a range of news, discussions and documentaries. For a full list of available podcasts, visit bbc.co.uk/Radio 4.